passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting live and on demand from Buffalo, New York, where today is Sunday, June 4th, 2023, and I'm joined today by our special co-host, MJ from NJ. Hello.
Hello, Brandon. It's an honor to be on the flagship show. Big shoes to fill. Shout out Chris. Shout out Jesse. No pun on the fill, but happy to be here.
Yes. Big shoes to P-H-I-L. If you will. Okay. So we've got AEW Collision to talk about. AEW Collision, an estimate on their TV deal. What is AEW's TV deal now that AEW Collision is a part of it? And I'm going to look at how much maybe AEW Collision is going to be preempted. Have you listened, MJ, to the latest Lightshed podcast?
I have.
You have? Of course you have. Maybe. Will WBD bid for both WWE and AEW? Will David Zaslav unite the wrestling universe? We'll find out.
Does the W in WBD stand for wrestling?
Yes. Wrestling Brothers Discovery. I wrote a little bit on the Patreon earlier this week or last week about what AEW's deal is. And we know from talking to Tony on the Thursday call before Double or Nothing, and then talking to him after Double or Nothing on the press conference, that AEW's TV deal is worth a little bit more now than it was before. So it's not just what I believe it is, you know, up until now, and this is what the Observer has reported back in January 2020, $43.75 million. So about $44 million average annual value. Tony has also tweeted a reply to someone trying to shut someone down from criticizing AEW or something. He did tweet, we have a multi-year deal for $175 million. So that all adds up with the notion that it's a $44 million per year average deal. And I asked him on Sunday night after Double or Nothing whether there was additional money. He said, yes, WBD is paying us to run TV, and everyone laughed. And I said, no, in addition to what you're already getting, by the way, we have a special guest here too. This is Fozzie Bear, who's here.
It's usually a three-man pod.
Yes.
Three-person pod.
He's going to do the timestamps. So we know according to Sony, they're getting more money, right? And I can't imagine that they're doing an extra weekly show that's going to cost them probably about $500,000 per week to run. I can't imagine they're taking that really big expense on without being paid more money. So what I want to try to answer here is, what is the new average annual value of AEW's TV deal with WBD? We know it's worth, in the first place, $44 million a year. Escalating each year. So the first year, which is now well in the past, something well under $44 million. And in the middle year, which is not quite a middle year in a 4-year deal, but somewhere in the middle, it's close, pretty close to $44 million. And then the last year, marginally over $44 million a year. So what is the incremental revenue that AEW is being given by WBD for running Collision? We'll look at what the expense is. It's probably about $500,000. I might be, a little low there. I think Raw or SmackDown probably costs about $1 million to put on. Maybe AEW Dynamite costs a little bit less. So $500,000 might be even a little bit low. But anyway, let's say $500,000, and let's be conservative here. So let's go $500,000 and multiply that by 52 weeks. Now, I know there's not 52 weeks left in the year. There's something like 28 weeks left in the year. But 52 weeks a year times $500,000 is $26 million per year in added expense. I got to think that AEW is getting at least enough money to cover the expense of these shows. So if you add about $26 million to the current value of the deal, which is $44 million, you get to $70 million. So something like $70 million per year is their new TV deal value, I believe, average annual value. And there's not that much left on this term. So $70 million, how does that compare, do you know, MJ, to the current WWE deals for Raw and SmackDown?
Significantly lower.
Yes. So we're still, do you know what SmackDown deal's worth?
The SmackDown deal, well, it's going to be entering the last year of it. So is it not going to be close to the 205 number?
The average annual value is $205 million. Do you know what the average annual value of the Raw deal is with NBC Universal?
Somewhere north of that. It's 265?
265. That is correct. Should be like a sound effect here. Ding. So we're still in a neighborhood that's like, you know, a fraction. What would that be? Mm-hmm. Something like a quarter of, you know.
At 265, you'd be just under 25%. Just over 25%.
Right.
And at 205, you'd be north of 65% roughly.
Right. So.
No, I'm sorry. Below by 65. 40 would be the inverse. 45%.
Yeah. A lot less anyway.
A lot less.
So this is sort of the what we're seeing here in video, if you're watching live on YouTube or on YouTube in general. This is the evolution of what has become this pretty complex deal between AEW and WBD, which started back in 2019 when AEW Dynamite debuted as the only show that AEW had. Do you remember when Dynamite was the only weekly TV show on linear TV that AEW had? They were getting something like maybe the cost of production plus an ad revenue share. I would think if you annualize that, that comes out to like less than $10 million a year. And then in January 2020, right before the pandemic, before anybody foresaw that the pandemic was going to shut down live events for about a year and a half, right before the pandemic, they got a new deal for 4 years. Well, 3 years with an option year for this current $44 million. Well, I guess it's now past $44 million a year. And that was with the addition of a 1 hour show that ended up being revealed as Rampage. I believe it was the following, maybe 2 years later, in fact, right? Anyway, it was revealed at an upfront in 2021 that it was going to be called Rampage, and now we have this 1 hour show. Plus they got the Battle of the Belts. By the way, I don't know if Battle of the Belts is going to be continuing on here. That's just my speculation. It sort of occurred to me, like, if you got Collision on Saturday nights, have we seen the last Battle of the Belts? I'm not sure.
Collision the successor to Battle of the Belts? Is it the evolution of Battle of the Belts?
Right. And it's not like this was, you know, this huge event that was key to AEW's creative and it was a huge rating success or something like that. It was basically an extra hour of Rampage.
It turned into an extra hour of Rampage. The concept upon first announcement definitely had, as a fan of AEW, I definitely read into it. Like, hey, this could be really cool. Like a special premium linear show that features title matches, perhaps important matches. Of course, it did not play out that way. But the concept itself, the initial design, seemed to have something to it.
And we all remember that Ric Flair versus Barry Windham match that happened at Battle of the Belts. Great match that you can probably find on YouTube. But anyway, so they got that upgrade of a deal, which was more content, right? So it's not just 2 hours of weekly content, but also Rampage and also a, you know, quarterly 1 hour specials, which I kind of got the impression was sort of a bone that was thrown to them for, you know, AEW kind of wanting to be on streaming, but not getting on streaming. So anyway, that's what's happened here. And now this deal apparently has been amended. The term has not changed. Tony Khan's been pretty clear about that. And I asked him on the Thursday call before Double or Nothing. Dave Meltzer asked him at the press conference. The length of the deal is the same. So this is not a $1 billion new five-year deal as rumored. No. This is the same term that is apparently going to expire, assuming the option is picked up at the end of 2024. Presumably, it's possible that the deal could expire at the end of the year. I think it's pretty likely that WBD picked up the option already. Certainly, if you're signing up for a new show, a new Saturday night show, I'm thinking you're going to take it for more than the 7 months here, or 6.5 months that are left of the year. So anyway, that's what I think. It's roughly or at least $70 million average annual value. I have to believe that WBD is picking up the option here. And then I would think that what's going to happen here is we're going to see how Collision is going to perform, what kind of ratings it can really deliver, not just on the first week when, you know, on June 17th, CM Punk's finally going to be back and people are going to tune in. And then the next week, not that many people are going to be tuned in for the Toronto show. And then the week after that, the tape show from Hamilton, currently under 1,000 tickets out. How many people are going to be watching, let's say, by August? What's the average late into the summer here? So the WBD knows what kind of rating that extra show is actually able to deliver. And then maybe they'll get into some real negotiations about what AEW's next TV deal may be worth. So I don't have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, the last time we spoke, there was a super chat I had once of is Warner Brothers Discovery definitely picking up that option? And I've always believed yes. It's like picking up a great rookie on a, you know, they pick up their rookie deal and extend them for as long as you can, keep it cost effective. I do like the idea that they are going to be able to test Collision. They're going to be able to test Collision in a Saturday time slot, a primetime time slot. I think that AEW's best interest is to lean very hard into making Collision closer to Dynamite and not Rampage. And when you get to the end of at least this year, while Warner Brothers Discovery can extend into 2024 and lock up everything as constituted as is, it also gives them the option to see what the landscape is once the NBA rights settle. Once you see what maybe they want to do with the NHL, they could really evaluate the landscape of their properties and what they are able to put on what night, what ratings it does, and use AEW to its advantage as good, cost-effective programming that has a great... Yep.
You think that the NBA deal will be done before the AEW deal?
I think by the time that the AEW deal is renewed, there will be a good understanding within Warner Brothers as to how and where the NBA is going to be distributed, where they fit into that, what nights, and then perhaps, you know, benefiting AEW, because AEW will probably go wherever Warner Brothers would like them to go as long as it's a sticky time slot. Then when you set up for that next full-term deal, they're able to sit down and come up with a real plan. And this summer and the rest of this year certainly seem to be like good testing grounds to use Collision. I know when we get into next spring, we'll run into preemption. And I think that's your next slide here, so if you want to go to that. But, you know, one of the things that has plagued Rampage is the preemption. And then we've moved around and we've seen Dynamite stay strong because it's been a constant. I think it would behoove both parties to discover what that constant can be with Collision. And for now, it'll be Saturdays. But when they ultimately settle on a new long-term deal, if that's what they do, I'm not saying it's going to be the same construct as it is now with nights and times. And I think all that's still play out.
So AEW Collision, it's obviously starting right after the end of the NBA Finals, the end of Stanley Cup Finals, which are happening right now. So I think it's no coincidence that all this is happening just as those playoff games are coming to an end for TNT and TBS, or at least for TNT. But if you look at what I did is I went into the Showbiz Daily data and I said, give me everything that touches 8 o'clock on Saturday on TNT. And this is what we get. We get, so for things that potentially are going to push Collision out of its time slot. And keep in mind, I did look back on Dynamite has almost not been preempted. I think it was preempted once this year and that's it. And nothing jumps out in mind to me that's like, what's going to preempt Dynamite for the rest of the year? So Dynamite seems to be pretty much in the clear here on this 8 o'clock Wednesday night TBS time slot, as opposed to TNT, where they were getting pushed around by, the introduction of the NHL and March Madness and things like that. So playoff anyway,
basketball, yeah.
Right. So what we have here is in 2022, they did put a regular season game on New Year's Day on TNT Saturday at 8. The NBA All-Star game. So I don't know if that will continue, but the NBA All-Star game looks like it will push it in February. Maybe another NHL game here that I found here in late February. But then we have March Madness that was on TNT on Saturday night on one, two occasions, and then NHL playoffs throughout May. an NHL playoff game in June of last year, baseball playoffs in October, and the match. I figured you might know something about the match.
I do. And all of the match is a property that can be moved around and utilized to the advantage of the schedule. I think of all of these, really, it's the March Madness that jumped out at me because that's such a big property and it's present across all of the T-Nets. When I think about something like the NBA All-Star Game, that to me is a property that maybe TNT doesn't have going forward, so therefore not a consideration. And that's where I think understanding the lay of the land with the NBA distribution will be important for them making longer-term decisions as to what to do with AEW and all of its brands and TV shows across the nights.
What is the match?
The match was a concept of creating golf matches made for TV, not full tournaments. And
it's invented during COVID, during the worst of the COVID shutdown?
It actually started with the first being held out in Las Vegas between Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson. It was their brainchild and quite successful at the time. Came around at the time that gambling was becoming a thing. So I remember participating and watching the first match, and you can bet on the holes between the guys. It was really a made-for-TV golf program content.
Did you participate in sports betting around the match?
Yes, I certainly didn't participate in the match. I participated but now going forward, they've gimmicked it, if you will. And I think the next one's going to feature Travis Kelce and Patrick Mahomes against Steph Curry and
in golf.
Yeah. So, and they've had Tom Brady participate. They've had Charles Barkley participate. He usually does a lot of color commentary. They've shortened their matches. Yeah. It's gimmicked. It's good content for, I wouldn't say good content as in quality. I'd say it's good content to fill the airwaves with something to draw eyeballs.
So it doesn't surprise me that someone who's involved in trading stock options is also involved in sports betting. Is there a crossover opportunity there?
I believe DraftKings
and Robinhood, should those two companies, are there a lot of synergies there?
They're competitors, Brandon. But to be honest, I actually have a pretty good view on, or a strong view, or not pretty good, a strong opinion that a lot of people are involved in sports betting, as evident by these TV ratings we are seeing, while the decline in the bundle seemingly doesn't affect the rise in ratings either year over year or what have you. And I draw the conclusion that it's driven by sports betting.
That's the argument. But if we're being more optimistic, if you look at the 2023 schedule, there was a soccer game in January, and there were only year to date here. I did leave out like a couple weeks of May, so maybe there was more here in May. But there's NCAA college basketball All Star game for the NBA, and some playoff games. So. Say that's the number, that's like five. I don't know what they'll be for the rest of the year. I imagine there's going to be probably a baseball playoff game. I guess it depends on what the schedulers want to do, is if there's an open slot on TBS to put some of this sports programming, maybe they would do that instead of preempting Collision. But we'll see. The point is, I think Collision is going to get preempted more than Dynamite, probably less than Rampage, though. Would be my expectation. So, and we've gone like something like seven consecutive months of Rampage. And I think that of Rampage getting preempted, I think that's been, among other factors, detrimental to their ratings. Just not having a really stable time slot. So the latest thought leadership from our friends at Lightshed has been the notion that, hey, look, Tony has confirmed that there's not a new term. There's not a new four-year deal. This deal is still expiring probably at the end of 2024. So that leaves perhaps Warner Brothers Discovery open to bidding among the players, bidding for Raw and or SmackDown. And it was they brought it up on their most recent podcast.
Shouted you out.
They read my tweet, yes.
The other Brandon.
Other Brandon. And so they brought it up in the context of, look at UFC, and is it PFL that's on ESPN?
Yeah, the Professional Fighting League. Is that the one that they cited?
So there's multiple MMA companies there under one TV roof. Could David Zaslav unite the wrestling world and put WWE and AEW all under one roof? And I was thinking about it. Let's be clear. On its face, I don't think this is going to happen.
Pure speculation.
But are we
on a collision course for AEW and WWE to coexist under one Turner, TNT, Warner Brother banner?
But the TV scheduling, when you think about it, does kind of work out. And now Nikon has been clear that they're willing to move SmackDown around for enough money. They're willing to move Raw around for a lot of money. But when does the NBA air on TNT? On Tuesdays and Thursdays, right? So that and they got Dynamite on Wednesday. That's pretty successful. So that does leave Monday and Friday open to them, I guess. Of course, they've got not just TNT, but TBS that some of this programming could go on.
True TV is the other.
Yeah, but I don't think you want your Raw or SmackDown to be on True TV.
You don't. But in the case of preemptions, we've seen Sci-Fi be used by NBCU. We've seen FS1 be used by Fox. So just the idea that there are other outlets that you don't have to necessarily move time slots, you can just move stations, is something that I think benefits Warner Brothers in their cable landscape and kind of how many shows they have, or how many networks they do have to play with.
Is there any real benefit, as stated, to getting all the wrestling under one channel? And I think it was brought up in the conversation mm-hmm. that Lightshed was having, that Brandon Ross and Rich Greenfield and Walt Piesecke were having around. It clarifies the messaging. All the wrestling is under one, maybe not one channel, but one or two channels within the same family that can be cross promoted and all of that much more easily. Is that a real accretive benefit for these companies and for the network?
Could be sliced and diced anyway. I mean, if you're thinking of it from a consumer standpoint, you get the benefit of consumers fully knowing this is the place I go for wrestling. There's an idea that you're going to turn over the brand into this is the home of wrestling, which may allow you to work with partners, strategic advertisers a little bit more seamlessly because everyone knows where to go for this type of content for delivery to that particular audience. On the flip side, you have to look at the fact that it would limit the audience, right? If you have the same audience tuning into your channels every single night, you're really not able to cross-promote too well to other types of programming content. If you look at the other side of the Warner Brothers Discovery has, I would say, a lot of content and a lot of stations that are unfamiliar to wrestling fans or who you would think the typical wrestling fan is. So the cross-promotion could be limited. So if you have every night of the week is pro wrestling, and that's what your audience is every single night of the week, you might box yourself in a little bit. Your total addressable market becomes a little bit less when you're going to advertisers, when you're going to try to cross brand with your other stations. So there's consumer benefits. There's also probably some business strategic setbacks that would occur with that.
Yeah, I'm not sure where NHL's on Wednesday nights, but I don't know if they're airing on Monday or Fridays.
The idea that Zaz, I think, as you know, he's known, it would move away from live sports and into pro wrestling is interesting to me because you probably can design a strategy that includes both, encompasses both, and work the wrestling around because we've seen wrestling fans willing to kind of migrate what nights they watch something.
He wants more AEW. Tony said.
And he wants more AEW. And I was going to say at the same
his
time,
idea.
You have to do the. There's a lot of ideas coming from executives pitch to wrestling executives these days.
Well, I think Vince and Tony, I can see WBD in their – they want cheaper programming, more economical programming. They've gone on there with Gunnar Weidenfels, who's the CFO of WBD, and they've talked about how they want to have cost discipline. They don't want more. They want better. They don't want to have spend on all this content that we've seen be the trend in media business throughout the last decade or so. But they want to make wise investments – you know, in less content, but content that's going to be more economical. And wrestling is, you know, wrestling. When I look at the ratings and say how much are they being paid, you know, relative as a factor of how much they're delivering. AEW is the biggest one in terms of being seemingly under monetized relative to what they deliver as a rating. But even WWE is too. Certainly relative to the bigger sports properties, it is.
Yeah, and that's where I was going to go with this. You have to do the calculus of what is the replacement cost. Obviously, Zaz has also said he's moving away from scripted programming, which, okay, if it's not going to be all in on live sports, it's not going to be scripted programming. Here is a happy medium that is very cost effective. It outperforms in terms of the ratings that it brings you. And it's definitely an area to kick the tires on in terms of whether or not that's a viable strategy to use more of that to fill your programming slate.
Okay. Any other thoughts there? I don't think so. I might write something about that this coming week for subscribers. By the way, if you want to contribute a super chat, if you want to have your question or comment addressed here, feel free to submit a super chat if you're watching live today on YouTube. I came across this account. Someone brought this to my attention. At Touring Data on Twitter is tweeting apparently, I mean, not it's wrestling. They almost never tweet wrestling, but are tweeting all sorts of concert event business data, including revenue for LiveGate.
Have you been following the concert industry this past year, summer? Not really. Leading into this summer?
I'm aware that Taylor Swift is a huge draw, though, and Live Nation is, you know, they're beating their 2019 numbers.
Yes. In average ticket prices through the roof.
Which I think we have a slide that we'll get to in a moment. So they tweeted this set of data for Double or Nothing, $964,000. $964,000 in live event revenue, in revenue for ticket sales. So I don't know where this data is coming from. I did DM the MJ's gone. I did DM the account to ask, is this, you know, based on ticket audits or whatever? I didn't get a response, but I did ask someone who would know how AEW Double or Nothing performed, and I was told that this is approximately correct, the numbers that we're seeing here. I would point out, though, that 100% tickets sold is obviously not accurate. This was not a sellout. As people may have seen the pictures that I tweeted, you've got clearly there were a number of open seats. So not a sellout, but I could believe that maybe 10,478 was close to the paid ticket sales, an average ticket price of $92. Anyway, I mean, the moral of the story here, under $1 million gate, I mean, that's what we believed. I believe the Observer has reported something in the neighborhood of $700,000 for the live gate. So there's that. But they also tweeted WrestleMania, and that's $9.5 million for a live gate for day one, $10.2 million for a live gate for day two, and... Can you turn your volume down a little bit? I'm getting a little bit of feedback.
Oh, my apologies. I did switch my connection here.
Okay. So this comes out to, I believe, 19.7 million dollars. What's 9.5 plus 10.2? It is 9.5 plus 10.2. $19.7 million. And we know WWE in their press release announced $21.6 million for the live gate. So, I mean, that probably includes fees, assuming this is accurate. $19.7 million is probably without the fees, and I would think $21.6 million, as WWE announced, is with the fees. So this all seems plausible. If you look at the number of tickets that they got for the paid ticket sales, 63,000 for day one, 64,000 for day two. That's consistent with WrestleTix estimates of tickets out being about 67,000 for each day, with day two being slightly higher than day one. So it's a bigger difference, presumably in tickets sold versus tickets out, for day two. But day two being bigger, you know, slightly higher average ticket price, slightly higher tickets sold for that Roman versus Cody match, apparently.
Do you have the historical averages for WrestleMania's prior years, and I guess how far back? Because one of the big trends, obviously, in this live event space now is the explosion in price, and both due to inflation but also due to demand in the experience economy now, and something that I think is definitely a tailwind in helping facilitate live event business in WWE.
Are you asking, like, the historical average ticket price for WrestleMania?
Yeah, sure. I guess how this compares and increases kind of over time.
So let's share this. Make this bigger so people can see it. So this is getting bigger. Okay. So this is last year. About $159 was WrestleMania last year. And then we have... I could probably find the 2021. I'm sure I could find the 2021 COVID year. But let's skip over that because I don't have that here. But 268 for the 2019 WrestleMania, 235 for 2018, 223 for 2017. And it's going to get smaller as the years go back.
This is actually the opposite of what I maybe would have expected to see, which was an increase in pricing.
This is going back, it was lower. Going towards the present, it's higher.
I'm sorry, I'm misreading how you're... Okay, keep scrolling.
I'm going in reverse chronological order.
Gotcha.
2008, it's about...
This is exactly then what I would expect to see. I apologize as you were
2008,
scrolling.
Let's go way back. 2008, $93 average ticket price for WrestleMania. And then it gets higher, a little bit up and down, but it gets higher and higher. It goes over $100 at about the early 2010s or so. And then once we get to late 2010s, we're into WrestleMania 32 with, in Arlington with the 100,000 attendance supposedly. Mm-hmm. And we get over $200 for the average ticket price. And, and then our average ticket price for this, now that we're splitting it into 2 days, right. That has lowered the average ticket price, more volume to sell here. So the tickets have gotten cheaper, expecting you to buy two tickets. Obviously, if you went to 2 days, you can kind of add these $150 up, times two, and that's like $300 to go to both events.
Yep.
So is this where we have the – I guess we'll touch briefly on AEW Collision. Now that CM Punk has been officially announced as being on AEW Collision on June 17th at the United Center, tickets distributed – for this 13,000 seat building or so, this 13,000 setup. I know WrestleTix has it at 10,000, but I'm sure they could open it up even further. 7,600 is what it's at, and this was as of Thursday. So not as of today, Sunday, but as of Thursday, the announcement of CM Punk has appeared to move around 600 tickets. So we'll see.
Do you believe news coming out today will further increase this, given the timing?
What news today?
Well, so my understanding, I did not wake up to watch it, but in Japan today, there were a few big matches announced. Seems like they're going to be Forbidden Door, I believe, a week or so after this Collision event. And I do wonder whether or not New Japan Stars will be on this Collision.
Were there Forbidden Door matches announced?
I do believe Omega and Osprey is now confirmed. Right? And I do believe Brian Danielson will be facing Kazuchika Okada.
Okay. Why would that affect Collision ticket sales, though?
Collision is taking place on June 17th. I believe Forbidden Door is on June 26th, the following week.
25th.
So, a week before, this is probably one of the bigger go-home shows you will have for that. This is probably in the biggest arena you'll be in before that show. I would think you want star power on your very first Collision. You have 2 hours of content to fill. You bring in an Okada. You bring in Brian Danielson in addition to CM Punk. You certainly don't know what CM Punk's role on Forbidden Door will be, but perhaps a Hiroshi Tanahashi or some big name like that. And all of a sudden, this United Center has a lot of star power in it and perhaps takes this to the rest of the way to the current setup at the very least. If not, they expand that current setup.
As a prospective consumer, I'm not convinced that I'm going to see Tanahashi or Okada on this show on Collision.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Maybe. But not currently.
Yeah. I would think that we didn't. As of last week, we did not know we'd see CM Punk on this show. And
well, I think we knew, but we did.
I think we know we are going to see New Japan Stars heading into Forbidden Door. Where and how they're utilized, I don't know. I think we did last year as well. Certainly in Go Home's for. Forbidden Door was a Dynamite where stars were appearing and they were introducing more New Japan talent, Jay White.
What else do we have here? Dominion last night they announced the attendance.
This was it.
Dominion announced the attendance at 7,040, which is higher than last year by about 1,000, which was just over 6,000. So Osaka Joe Hall, same venue, same event, always at Osaka Joe Hall. So their attendance was better. I didn't look back into further years like 2021 because I imagine it was more of a limited capacity. But there's that. Then we have a market-to-market comparison, more live events. The moral of the story here is that in May, positive trends continue for WWE and live events, despite the return of Vince McMahon to ruin creative again. We've got basically almost every market-to-market comparison that I can make across common event types was positive for WWE. Albany Raw, positive. Fayetteville, North Carolina, with the I don't want to say false advertisement, the accidental or maybe gone back on advertising of Roman Reigns. That was way up, but maybe that's just okay. There was an advertising error or change in decision there. Okay, Greensboro Coliseum, Raw, up 67%. North Charleston, South Carolina, house show up. Augusta, Georgia, house show up 50%. Knoxville, Tennessee, SmackDown, up 68%. Jacksonville, Florida, in the belly of the beast. WRAW up 44%. And we've got Fort Worth, Texas, where they did a Raw. I don't have a Raw to compare it to since the return to touring, but I do have a SmackDown to compare it to. It's up 10,600 versus 8,500 on the SmackDown. And obviously, this is a month that also included the San Juan, Puerto Rico events that, you know, did pretty huge business there.
And this is where I would be keenly interested to understand the ticket pricing strategy. We saw live events become a profitable segment within the WWE business reportings of the earnings. So for me, it's okay. Are they able to drive higher ticket prices with the increased attendance? Is it the increased attendance alone that's driving this? Certainly the efficiencies and scaling of production costs as they travel city to city. They've been doing this for how long now? And they learned probably a lot coming out of the pandemic of how to keep costs a little tighter. So that's where, you know, I think you're starting to see a lot of tailwinds push that WWE live event business revenue and profitability.
So average ticket price, domestic ticket price in U.S. and Canada has this is based on WWE's reporting, which they report every quarter. It's a little bit skewed because Q2 or whatever quarter that WrestleMania is contained in always drives everything way up, including average ticket price, including attendance. And they don't break that for average ticket price. They don't break that out.
Right.
Maybe I could back that out. But anyway.
It's hard to calculate, hard to back. And it also very market specific dependent. You're probably going to be able to drive higher prices in certain markets than others.
So what I did here, what we're seeing for people watching in video is this is a trailing 4-quarter average trend line is what we're looking at here. It's to try to adjust for that, to adjust for the fact that 1 quarter out of the year is going to be way higher than the rest because of WrestleMania. In any case, and then I adjusted this for inflation to 2023 dollars. And, you know, look at the light green line there, and it's up and to the right, beginning in 2006, where it's around just over $50 was the average ticket price in today's dollars. And I mean, it was in those days, dollars was about $35. You could get into a WWE show for an average ticket price of $35, or in today's dollars, about $50. And now it's up to $80 in today's dollars, or maybe more like $75. You see that the first quarter in return to touring drove this way up. So they really priced tickets high at the beginning of the return to touring in July 2021.
Naturally, with demand.
Pent up demand,
so you can naturally drive pricing through. Yep, exactly. And do you believe that they came out of the pandemic when they came back to touring with a much better cost structure on their live events? Right? Did they learn things when they were producing TV in isolation and say, okay, we can do certain things that more cost effective that would combat maybe the inflation that was being felt and being seen? Because we haven't really seen that be a drag on that live event business. You know, and I would think that while attendance is up, ticket pricing is up, if costs were up too, it may not be the profitability that we are seeing.
So what I do in my, when I estimate WWE's financial reports, I do a live event operating expenses per the number of events that they run. So I guess the answer to that, if the answer to that question is yes, if the you know, the question is WWE running events more efficiently? Are they running their events at a lower cost? Then I would expect this number. I'll share it here. I would expect. I've got to make this way bigger because this is small stuff.
So I love the WrestleNomics spreadsheets.
This is the operating expense. This is the selling and marketing expense. This is in millions. So what we're looking at here is like, you know, $4 million per event. Is that right? Yes, because that's WrestleMania. We're talking like 300,000 per event, 400,000 per event. So what you want to ask here is what, if we go back in time here and let's say 2019, where it was costing them, you know, in live event operating expense. So I take the total of what they actually report for live event operating expense, and then I just divide it by the number of events that they reported that they ran, and we get, you know, something in the neighborhood of $300,000 that they're spending in operating expense. That's not including the marketing expense, which is another several tens of thousands of dollars. So it's not that big of a difference, right? But so something in the neighborhood of $300,000, getting towards $400,000 per event in live event operating expense. Okay, so what are they doing now? They're in Q1. They report about the same, and maybe that's with inflation over that time. You could say maybe that's more efficient.
Pretty good, if the I would think so. And I think especially if you're adding increased attendance on top of a pretty consistent number from prior to pandemic, that's a good win. That's a very good I'd give them high marks on that business turnaround with the live event business. And I think that that continues to get better over time as they continue to further their reach with their audience, which seems to be growing, getting younger, and they implement new creative strategies that draw people to these events.
And to this point, the point you brought up earlier, I mean, we can go back in time and say, look at operating income just for the live events division. So that is the answer to the question, are live events profitable? We know with media and all these, you know, enormous TV rights fees that you get from NBC Universal and Fox and other partners that you're a very profitable business. But if you isolate the live events business and look at operating income, this was a division that outside of WrestleMania quarters like this one was losing money. Right? It was losing, you know, a couple million dollars in a quarter in some years. This is 2020, so let's not look at that too seriously, but we can go back to 2018 and we can find, you know, some of these quarters, you know, thinly making a profit or losing $1 million.
And if people remember, this was definitely something that was trending poorly to the point where Vince wanted to reimagine what live events would be. It was definitely an eyesore in their report, in their earnings each quarter. It was something headed in a direction where it needed to be reimagined. So,
and we can see here in 2022 and the first quarter of 2023, I know we got this big quarter here in Q2. That's because of WrestleMania, where they made $13 million in operating income. But every other quarter, I mean, that Q4 came pretty close, but they made $300,000 in operating income.
Q3 is going to be also skewed now with the advent of SummerSlam being in a stadium. And
this
I think
was
they did
Clash of the Castle that helped here too.
Well, that was Clash of the Castle. And when was SummerSlam then? August? No, that's Q3. Yeah, Q3.
Yeah.
So not only are they able to, I think Q4 is a great quarter to examine this because you do have the live touring around the holidays. And we know that's consistent. We also know that they don't have the PLE in Saudi Arabia included in this number here, I don't believe.
No.
So this is a pretty clean quarter to compare year over year.
$50 million goes into the media bucket, not the live event bucket.
So if you just looked at the fourth quarter year over year, you'd be able to see kind of that real core going to the markets, going to the lower, going to smaller metros, going to the local fan base. That business that we used to think of as their live touring business, not clouded by all the PLEs in the stadiums. And it's a turnaround in the face of inflation, in the face of a potential recession, vibe session, whatever anyone wants to call it. That's a pretty good mark to be at from 2022 and then now heading into 2023, where they're able to just turn a profit. Because if you want to think about live events as the cost of getting to your customer, right? That's the most direct way that they are going to get in front of people who maybe have never been to an event. You and Jesse have talked about it at an event. Like what purpose does live events serve? And at the very least, in a case of WWE, a more mature business, they can't be losing money there. If you're losing money there, why are you doing it? Because look at all the other areas that you're being so successful in, right? AEW is in a more nascent state. They need to invest in getting to that audience. It's okay to maybe lose money in the live touring. But I would say for WWE, break even is the bare minimum. You know, from an investor standpoint, you want to see that as a bare minimum. And this is a nice turnaround there in the face of what I would have thought would be rising costs.
And we should note this may be the biggest factor of all, is that they're running fewer house shows. If we look back in 2017, where they're running 60, 70 house shows per quarter, they did run only 50 some odd. But they did start to cut down on that in 2019. I think when, you know, in response probably to the lack of profitability in the live events division, and now, you know, fully up and running again, only 20 to 30 house shows per quarter here. I mean, that's they've cut that and, basically in half.
And that's not to say that, oh, they cut them in half, so look, they're not losing this money. That is a strategy. They have chosen to do less house shows in a way to drive this segment to profitability. I think that's a nice – you can't discount when a company undertakes a strategy to achieve something and then say, oh, it's because they run less shows, right? You can't hand wave that when it's an obvious conscious strategy for them to try to do this.
Okay. So
– Brandon, how do I sound and how's my connection now that I had to flip over?
You sound very good.
Okay.
In AEW land – we don't have, obviously they run a lot fewer events. So there's fewer comparisons to make here. New markets still. San Diego was a new market for them. Austin, Texas is a new market for them. House shows happened. Two more house shows. One in Salem, Virginia did 2,100. Another one in Corbin, Kentucky did 1,600. They did some this weekend. I don't have the numbers in front of me and I don't know if that WrestleTix has given those a final count yet. In any case, Las Vegas. Yes.
I was going to ask, did you see that Darby Allin skateboard trick?
No.
I saw it on the – oh, it was impressive. But go ahead. Sorry.
Las Vegas.
It was a house show last night, so yeah.
Las Vegas, Double or Nothing, was down 20% according to WrestleTix count versus the Double or Nothing of last year, which was over 13,000 tickets out for Double or Nothing 2022. This year, 10,500. So down 20%. And the Dynamite was down 8% from the previous Dynamite in Las Vegas as well. Detroit, Michigan for Dynamite down 36% from the previous Dynamite in June of last year, which is probably the Blood and Guts event. And Baltimore was up. Baltimore Dynamite in May 3rd, it was up 21% from the previous Dynamite they did in Baltimore, which only did 2,700 apparently in November of last year. So there's that. Mostly, some story here is mostly negative stories market to market for Dynamite, mostly positive stories for WWE. And we're getting to the point here, you know, we're not in this month of May, but in the previous 2 months, April and March, Dynamite was averaging a lower tickets distributed from WrestleTix than house shows were. This does include some international house shows. But SmackDown, and I know SmackDown did a double taping because of travel to Saudi Arabia. So they did three SmackDown tapings here rather than four, maybe even five. But this was the highest average for a month since the return to touring for SmackDown, doing around 12,000 out for SmackDown in May, which is higher than any average that we've got here in this chart, which includes SmackDown, Raw, Dynamite, and house shows. So that's, I mean, it's interesting to look at how correlated apparently in some of this time Raw and SmackDown are, where they're moving up and down. Maybe that has somewhat to do with the markets that they're going to. I haven't looked deeply into it, but it's a positive live event story still for WWE. The TV ratings continue to be pretty positive. And despite, you know, Vince is back in creative, and I know there may be a delay. If Vince is impacting, you know, if the creative is getting worse and if fans are tuning out of WWE, you would probably see that in a more delayed trend with live events because a lot of the tickets are bought when they go on sale at first. Nonetheless, these are still performing. You know, there's still some action, I'm sure, happening towards the end of these events on the day of the event. And they're still performing better than, you know, the event as a whole is still performing better than the events of the past. And TV ratings certainly wouldn't be a delayed effect in that way, right? You decide in that moment whether you're going to turn the TV on or not. And TV ratings are doing pretty strongly as well.
When would you like me to eat crow on the TV ratings?
How about now?
Or should I? Okay.
How about now?
go ahead. You go, and then I want to make a broader point about go ahead. I want to make a broader point about the two companies that are not comparing them, but looking at them in terms of where they are as businesses. But talk about the ratings, because the ratings play into that tremendously.
Most recently, Friday night, Fox, no more NBA to go up against. All that NBA competition out of the way, finally. Fox, SmackDown, 1,000 days for Roman Reigns.
And knowledge.
We don't have the final yet. The final will come out on Monday afternoon, Nielsen delays notwithstanding. But this looks to have done 2.5 to 2.6 million viewers, which is on the level of, if you can see my mouse here, this thick purple error bar is where I project the final to be for Friday night's SmackDown. And if you look at this one back here, that's very high. This is the Cena SmackDown of December 30th, where he came back and did this big rating. It's in that neighborhood. So this is going to be perhaps the most watched SmackDown of the year in 2023 so far. We'll see what happens on the final. I'm not aware of any preemptions that would have given us a misleading reading here. And it's the and programminginsider.com has reported the fast affiliates for each half hour. We don't have labels yet here. Well, I imagine we'll have a quarter hour report down the line here. So what we have is not quarter hours, but half hours. And this is in fast affiliate. So figure these are all about going to end up probably around 5 to 6 to 9% higher, maybe 4%. They're going to end up a little bit higher than this. So don't put this on the aggregators. But to give you an idea of how the show trended throughout the show, I think this is pretty reliable. And what we see here in the last half hour, which contained the Roman Reigns 1,000-day celebration, this peaks as the show goes on. The audience starts out, you know, lower and ends up higher with, you know, 2.7 million viewers measured by the fast affiliate. So figure that's going to be, you know, getting close to, it's going to be under 3 million. Okay, let's not get crazy here. But it's getting close to 3 million, maybe 2.8 million, something like that. The demo grew 13% from the prior 30 minutes in the last half hour, grew 9% in the last half hour from the prior 30 minutes. So no Sami Zayn here. So you can't say, well, this was, it's not really Roman Reigns who's a draw here. It's really the Sami Zayn storyline. Well, it's the storyline overall. and it's, I think Roman
has to be acknowledged. There's nothing else you can say. Acknowledge him.
Yes, as Roman Reigns looked into the camera and wanted to be acknowledged as the draw that he is. So there's that. TV ratings overall, though, I mean, if I look at the big spreadsheet off on my other screen here, TV ratings in May for Raw and SmackDown, total viewership was up 9% in May versus the prior year for SmackDown. Raw was up 4%. The demo was up 20% for both. NXT was also up 20%. Dynamite was down. So,
how's that NXT demo?
The demo is up 20% in May versus the prior year.
Oh, sorry. You were quoting the demo. Right. Okay. Sorry. You were saying the demo. It's a tremendous turnaround for what had become an aged audience. I think for a long time we had been seeing it be carried by 50 plus, and now we are seeing a really healthy increasing demo for the first time in what might be two, three generations, where the growth in viewership is coming from the younger audience.
To that point, what you really want to look at here is look at what we're looking at here in video is we're going all the way back, and we can scroll quite a ways back here. Mm-hmm. And you can see, so here's Raw and SmackDown, right? And it's been positive year over year differences when you compare the given month to the same month of the prior year. We've got positive differences, at least. Yeah, January not so positive for SmackDown, but it's mostly positive differences. And it's mostly positive differences. But if you scroll way back here, it's actually more positive than I expected. And that's SmackDown because, you know, SmackDown's been moved to Fox.
Where it's the distribution there is going to skew that a bit, yeah.
But if we look at, like, you know, I guess we can go way, way back for Raw. And we can see, you know, a lot of negative trends here in 2018, let's say, for one thing. I bet I have this going even further back. We should do something really dangerous and see if I can populate these.
I'm hard-pressed to think of a time when the growth in the demo came from – or the growth in total viewership came or was supported by the demo. Probably wasn't looking at ratings when Cena was coming up. But
it's even bigger in the younger half of the demo. If we look over here, this is 18 to 34, and it's up 30% in May, up 30% for SmackDown in April. So and NXT – this is going to be artificially volatile, I think, because we're dealing with a small sample for a smaller audience in NXT, but NXT is way up in the younger half of the demo as well.
But even still, when NXT first debuted, it did probably appeal to an older audience who had been watching it on the network. If you just think of the composite and the demographic of who was a subscriber to the network and who was watching Raw and who was watching SmackDown when it was pre-Fox, I think the composite was definitely an older demographic, skewed to the higher end of whether it
wouldn't
was
the streaming audience be inherently younger, because
the WWE's streaming audience, I would think, would reflect what the audience was watching the product on linear. I don't know that to be for sure. I would think that was who was probably subscribing to the network and then making NXT popular on the network. I don't know that I have that data, but it would align with
the audience has gotten younger. If we look at the median age trend here, it's getting close to what the SmackDown age is, which is getting a little bit older in recent months, in fact. But as we've mentioned before here, Raw is now younger than the Rampage audience. Raw is now younger than the Rampage audience. Dynamite is still the youngest show of all, though. So I think, what does this mean? I feel like this means something, but I'm not really, I can't really articulate it. It means something like relevancy. I feel like, you know, because TV ratings are so skewed to be older naturally, you know, the average TV viewer at any given moment is something like 60 years old, that you've actually got younger people who are more fickle when it comes to TV. I'm not just being an old millennial here saying that, but younger TV viewership is harder to retain. And when you see big increases in viewership, say for a big episode like the CM Punk return on Rampage, massive increase in younger viewership. I think just younger viewers are more selective with the time that they give to traditional TV.
And I think younger viewers are making their way to the product. Let's say the core product here is the TV shows, Raw, SmackDown, Dynamite, and Rampage Collision. I think younger audiences are brought into the product vis-a-vis, like you said, streaming or video on demand content, YouTube. Certainly, the network effects that the social media platforms all play in kind of introducing things to younger audiences, because we know that's where younger audiences are. And then if it really draws the eyeballs, you're now seeing that, in what is a younger audience watching on linear, which is really amazing, because you don't see that across many other linear cable programming, but you are seeing what seems to be a generation-long investment in trying to get their – they talk about the AVOD numbers, and they talk about how many people, the impressions in the social media world, whether it's TikTok, YouTube, and it's not monetizable, but what is monetizable are these upcoming TV rights that if you work hard enough to introduce your product to that younger audience, and if you do the right things with that creative, with that content, with those stars, to bring them in to watch your product, and you can turn your demographic from being an older demographic into a younger demographic, and you show that ability to deliver that audience to advertisers, boom, there's your monetization. And that is where we may start to see, I'll say, justified increases on those TV deals, because it's not just – well, this is what people watch on cable. It's also they are showing the ability to bring us younger viewers by way of their content across all the platforms. And to me, that is a real success story in what they've been able to do. Now, a lot of it benefited by Hunter's creative or by change in perception as to who is in charge of things.
By Vince's creative. Vince is the one who's really in charge.
Change in perception as to who is in charge of things. But – even prior to Vince leaving last summer, right, they had always been talking about reaching consumers where they are, whether that be Facebook when they tried the Facebook Live, whether that be YouTube. And we may talk about how monetizable that is, but I think you're seeing that strategy now really have dividends. And it couldn't happen at a better time with these TV rights upcoming.
Two things. Do you have any positions currently in WWE stock? And secondly, are you still a bear on WTV rights?
I have several lottery ticket options that is
on WWE.
Yeah. So if they come out with 2X TV rights, lotto tickets, right? But I don't own any shares, and I am not trying to gauge where WWE is going one way or the other. It's literally like playing the lotto. A few options for way out into like the 120s in case there's some massive TV rights surprise as there was in 2018.
So Nick Khan, if you're listening, you can make MJ rich if you do a good job.
Rich is a bad term to use, but look, I think that WWE content has always been forgot about in the mainstream conscious when it comes to these TV rights. Now, after 2018, it is certainly not the case anymore. Talk about Lightshed, they talk about pretty regularly, talk about all the other sports media podcasts and outlets that cover it. It's no longer a secret, right? But in the event that it still surprises, that's why I call them lottery tickets. Now, as your other question, am I bearish on the TV rights? Based on the stock price, 1.5 is a given. Anything less would be extremely disappointing and I think be significantly harmful to the start of TKO. But Yeah, if 1.5 is the given, I think it comes in around 1.5, 1.7, and I am no longer bearish as I was thinking that they would not get a renewal. I think the renewal will come in.
Or who's going to buy Raw and SmackDown?
Well, different topic, but I believe that renewal for increased rights will be justified by way of the younger demo that is now watching the shows. I think it'll be justified by ways of splitting up the rights, whether it be next day or whether it be packaged in the case of NBCU with a coterminous deal with Peacock and the PLEs. So I think there are ways that you can get to that. And after watching and listening to a lot of things about the NBA rights, that's how they're going to be able to get a significant increase, is by carving up distribution. I think WWE also creatively get increases, but it takes more and more for it to be justified. So I think that's, I won't walk off the ledge of sports rights are in a bubble. I will say that they are being creatively justified by partners who recognize that we have to do something to, make sure we retain the content, but also that the content is providing us multiple opportunities here to have it at a reasonable price.
Yeah, I think we are coming near to the plateau of sports TV rights being explosive. At the JP Morgan conference, Nick Khan talked about taking the NBA's lead and selling TV rights to multiple partners. That's what they did in 2018, not just NBCU, but also SmackDown, Fox. He made a sort of offhanded comment. He said something to the effect of, we're thinking we can maybe split it even more ways than that. What is he talking about? He's talking about selling to three different partners? How would that work?
I think we need to read, not read into what he says so literally, but think conceptually what it could look like. He could be talking about next day rights. He could be talking about exclusive content for other platforms that want it. Maybe not Raw, maybe not SmackDown, maybe something like a main event that can wind up on a in a streamer somewhere, and they kind of try to build that up into something more than it already has been, which is frankly nothing. But they keep producing it, so it's got to be for some reason.
He's satisfying international commitments.
Right, of course. And does that present opportunity then to create something domestically with that? And, the third hour of Raw has always been this taboo thing that fans don't like, but has to exist because of the revenue it brings. And can they do something with that on Peacock and make it a little bit more mature? Or can they do something with SmackDown, adding a third hour somewhere? I think there's a lot of ways they can split the rights or further monetize what they have to offer. Again, it's creative, and it's a way to justify for the buyers, why are we spending all this money, what are we getting for it, right? Both sides want to feel like they're getting something out of this, and I think for the buyers, the distributors, they want to feel like they have more because they're paying more. And it's a weird way of thinking about it, but hey, if we're going to pay you more, we want something else too. We want extra.
More content.
Right. And
that's what WBD is apparently doing with AEW. Saying,
exactly.
Don't just give us 3 hours. Give us five.
Exactly. And so Nick Khan probably has a couple ideas of how they can go to market with that strategy. And I'm
3 hour SmackDown. 5 hour Raw.
A 2 hour Raw with a
third hour of NXT.
Hour somewhere. There's a lot of ways you can do this. And we've seen them try to do this before, right? They did do some kind of rights deal for the mixed match challenge with Facebook. We've seen them try to explore this where they try to build up brands that, whether or not they're critically acclaimed, fans like it or not, to the degree they bring eyeballs and to the degree that they are able to create new ways to bring eyeballs, it's worth trying, especially if you can get paid for it.
He talked about, after the deal is over, notably, about maybe another show that would, appeal to the Latin American market and some sort of, he used the words lucha libre. Mm-hmm. So, and it was brought up in the context of like, how do you think about creating more content or growing? And he talked about nights of the week and, if we had it our way, we'd have content every night of the week. I mean, they have Monday as it's composed now, they have Monday, Friday, Tuesday, and you could put something on Wednesday, certainly, or Thursday. Thursday is the most open one, I suppose. But if there's a new TV brand, that sounds like it, but he's putting that after this TV deal. So it's not something they're going to deliver as part of this TV deal. It sounds like
it could be something that is to come after the TV deal, but, an option or a, the first right of refusal that a lot of these networks have, where they, hey, we're going to see this first, and if we don't want it, then you can shop it elsewhere. But maybe that's built into the contract, where NBCU is going to get the first rights at everything, and if they want to pass, then they can shop it. Something like that, where, again, just to justify an increase here in this environment, where at least there could be more coming, again, after the initial deal.
W stock price, this is the one-year picture. This is the five-day picture. W didn't have a great week for its stock price. Neither did Endeavor, but they were basically flat. There were some down days and some up days. Anyway, it finished basically where it started during the week.
There's a lot of activity there going on, probably with the M&A, kind of the hedging, de-hedging, things of that nature that would take place around any M&A transaction.
What's happening with the volume? Do you have any conspiracy theories?
Volume's back low. No, it's low. At least it was low when I saw it. I was in New York all week, so I really was not in front of the charts or anything. I was actually doing other things. And I think there's probably going to be it's going to stay pretty stable here until we get closer to the close of the transaction. And or things start to percolate with the TV rights. And I think that you probably saw it come back a bit as a hedge against what if the TV rights are not what is baked in, which I would say, and you've said before, 1.5. And as Nick was out doing the rounds and as the upfronts were happening and there was maybe a lack of visibility for the WWE at NBCU, if I understand correctly, that, you know, maybe people just said, oh, maybe it's not going to be as,
and Fox. I mean, so what happened here, and this is something that Lightshed talked about a couple of weeks ago, is that apparently there was a meeting between Endeavor people and their investors where they basically told the investors to basically brace yourselves for Fox not making a strong bid on WWE. So that, and then the next day was, I believe, the Moffitt-Nathanson conference, and Nick did not directly address that, obviously, but this is when he said 1.5x, that under promise, over deliver. We hope it's going to be more than that, but we're still going to get a great deal. And that's where I think the market said, okay, we were baking in 1.7, 1.8, but we're baking in 1.5 now. And that's why the stock price has changed in the last couple of weeks.
And when you say baking in, there's an expectation that it could potentially be 1.7, 1.8. I think baked into the price based on a valuation, like, right, what would revenue have to be to derive this $9 billion valuation? I think there you can probably get to, like, what's really in this, because it's already priced at the $9 billion. That's what Endeavor probably thinks is going to occur at the very least. And that's where I say baked in 1.5, the over or under promise, over deliver, the expectation, the guidance could be that it would be higher. And I have not heard Nick guide to higher at all. Just that, you know, I think he was on record of saying the 1.5, but under promise, over deliver was what he was looking to do. Mm-hmm. If it comes in lower, right, I think it's hard to get to that $9 billion valuation, just from a revenue standpoint, without real cost cutting or other revenue streams, revenue drivers. And we could talk about those because I think those are already in place. Certainly the PLEs are
one of them.
When
you say $9 billion valuation, are we talking about the market cap?
The TKO, when that closes, it will value WWE. I know equity value around 9.3, but I thought from a stock price equivalent, it would be around $9 billion. And it trades around...
It's about $7.5 billion right now in market cap.
So the equity value, $9 billion. And part of that would then be that market cap.
How do you know how equity value is calculated? I don't.
Equity value?
Yeah.
Would be the value placed on all equity and assets, liabilities. So like everything includes debt. And probably because WWE did not have significant debt, increased the equity value because they didn't have any liabilities. So you view that favorably and come to a higher valuation. And certainly gave Endeavor opportunity to offload some of its debt to TKO.
So equity value, is it like market cap plus cash and assets?
It's market cap. And I went back and watched what we did.
Someone is writing me an email right now, I'm sure.
Market cap would be shares outstanding times the price. And that's the public market. That's all the investors, all the shares outstanding. Equity value
basically
would be
101 as it is right now, times about 77 million basic shares.
Right.
It comes out to apparently about $7.6 billion.
We can trust Google Finance here, although maybe you want to ask the AI what it might be. But
we should just look at the filing and say this is the number. Yes. It's usually around 77 million shares.
Equity value would then look at assets and liabilities as well. So that includes debt. and would come up to a different value. And I don't believe that there's a true science to that. I think there's a bit of art to that, which is what kind of multiple do you put on things? And we've certainly seen WWE use all different kind of EBITDA, adjusted EBITDA numbers. So that's above my head in terms of the M&A transaction world.
I'll look at my DMs later. I'm sure someone will lecture me on what EV is. Okay.
I am not a financial expert.
Okay. Disclosure. what else have we got? I guess that's – I'm skipping over the merchandise thing. So I don't know. We could talk about succession.
Let me go back and make this kind of broader point and something I've been thinking about and wanted to kind of share as I was preparing for today. There's a saying in business that your margin or your market share is my opportunity. Right. When somebody runs away with an industry like the WWE did with pro wrestling, right, they are able to almost become a monopoly. They have the dominance in the market in terms of viewership, market share, in terms of TV rights, and the market share of the TV rights, right, if you think of the total slice of the pie. And here comes Tony Khan, right? That's my opportunity. I'm going to stand up my own wrestling promotion. I'm going to figure out ways to create value in the form of TV rights, which we saw after 2018, WWE had completely capitalized on. On the flip side of that, and where I kind of draw the parallels into pro wrestling and certainly where we are now in terms of live event attendance, in terms of ratings, in terms of engagement, and overall, I think, critical acclaim, is that WWE looked at the disruptor and they said, well, what was the disruptor's playbook to be able to eat into our slice of the pie? Now Lightshed's talking about them next to us. So how'd they get there? And they evaluated the playbook and they said, oh, they do interesting creative. They try to tell stories. They push the talent that people seem to organically want to see. And it's harkens back to what Triple H, Paul Levesque, had done with NXT when NXT reached its peak. And I was reminded of that listening to the great guys at John and Way at Post Wrestling. They did a throwback show looking at Brooklyn. And
I was there live for that. Yeah.
I had missed it because I had every Brooklyn show for like the first few, I just had to be out of town on for some reason. But peak NXT was a play on what was going on in the indies, right? What was resonating with fans? They started to bring in talent from those areas, those indies, the promotions outside, and they started to feature them. And that worked. All of a sudden, what was getting critical acclaim outside of WWE was working for WWE as a niche, as an offering to bring those fans back. And you look at now what Triple H has been able to do since he's come into this creative control, and whoever has control, whether it's perception, reality, or not, Triple H obviously has his fingers on
much Paul more Levesque, than Vince McMahon, or the Wizard of Oz, whoever's doing it, is doing it.
And we can say that, would you agree, Paul is definitely more influential in the product that we are seeing on TV than he was when he was frankly at home and having health issues.
Right.
So
as Jesse, when I made that point last week, you know, during, let's say, July 2022 through December 2022, that's the time where Triple H, you know, Paul Levesque had the most influence, I think, but he still has more influence now than he did before July 2022 at any point.
And you can certainly see that what was working then and what proved to work in the case of Sami Zayn's popularity and in the case of the Bloodline storyline, in the case of the handling of Cody Rhodes, is certainly dominant now in what the offering is, what the content is. So I look at that and I say, where in 2018 or whenever it was that Tony Khan looked at the opportunity and said, okay, well, I'm going to use their stranglehold on the market as my opportunity. I think Triple H looked at his competitor, looked at the disruptor in the space, and they said, well, I'm going to use that playbook in order to win on my end. But the difference is when I win on my end, I already have that institutional power, that institutional scale, and it's that much easier to turn it around, you know, to basically get the success more quickly because they have all that institutional firepower with the brand, with the bigger audience that has always watched WWE. So implementing that playbook, what took a long time for the disruptor to do and what the disruptor is still trying to achieve is much more easily achieved by the institutional brand. And it was a matter of just looking over there and saying, hey, I'll borrow from that playbook and why not? And I think that's what we are seeing play out now. And it's a very interesting time for both companies because they are both doing well. They are both taking their steps towards where they're going next. They're not comparable to me. They are in different parts of their life cycle. I know the fans like to compare the ratings. They like to compare the content. They like to say whataboutisms. The reality is one is it was a startup that's now coming into its next stage of its life cycle. That's AEW. The other one is an institutional brand that many thought were on its heels, but has been able to borrow from that disruptor playbook in order to turn around things like live attendance and like ratings and get younger demo. And I think that's what's being played out here. And from a business case study standpoint, that to me has been fascinating over the last 6-7 months.
Okay. A couple things here. As Nick Khan would say. So you think that WWE really, you know, looked at what AEW did, which was disruptive and on its own scale successful, and said, look at the things they're doing and we're going to learn from that. I guess my issue is that I don't think that what AEW did was like revolutionary. Like,
no, it wasn't.
I think for me, my perspective is always just that, like, Vince wanted to do things in a very specific way that matched his personal taste more so than it matched the market taste, which he confused. And the reduction in his influence over the product is the key to everything.
And I think that was very singularly Vince, and maybe Vince's chosen yes men. I think in the absence of Vince, it allowed for people that I think knew better to do better. I think that was always the opportunity at hand when Vince was stepped away and was out of control. And it's not that they looked over and they said, we're going to copy them. The reality is, a lot of fans
that like a proof of like, hey, look, this works. This convinced.
Yeah, so
like that would convince Vince McMahon that like, well, I've got to give it to him. Then we've got to do things more the way that they do it.
I think that's not what you're saying.
Explain to me what you're saying.
What I'm saying is, I think it's undeniable. A lot of fans were turned off by where WWE was going under Vince's singular control and creative control. They explored avenues of alternatives, whether that was New Japan, whether that was Ring of Honor, whether that was ultimately AEW. And what was it that they were doing? How were they utilizing their stars? How were they telling stories that resonated with fans that were turning off Raw and SmackDown? Certainly not getting younger fans, although that can be argued it's just a matter of time before the video on demand and the social network effect of it all took place. But Paul Heyman, Triple H, even somebody like Bruce Pritchard, who is tied into Conrad Thompson, who certainly benefited from the success of StarCast and rode the wave of All In, the first one around, they had to have known where those fans were going and why. And while you can't convince Vince McMahon to get off of his Iron Fist rule, the minute the opportunity presented itself, they could start to try. And once the business metrics started to show the receipts, the proof that this might work, and all of a sudden, hey, look what we can do with PLEs. Look where we can go with Sami Zayn if we just consistently push Sami Zayn. Look where we can go with these talents if we just give them a bit more of the rub of, hey, we believe in them too.
And in defense of your argument, Vince McMahon. He's a full-time employee now again. Mm-hmm. He's got an employment contract that's been disclosed. He did go to TV after the night after WrestleMania. Mm-hmm. He hasn't returned to TV. He's still involved in creative. I mean, you can read the reports from places like Fightful, and we can draw our own conclusions about what the reality of the situation is. In any case, he's not as involved as he was a year ago at this time.
There's always this initial reaction when somebody's out of something, like, oh, it's all going to go terrible. I need to be there. If I'm not there, it's going to fall apart. And we saw that in their writings about, you know, their business disclosures It was always, if Vince McMahon is such a critical part of this company and without him, there's material impact, right? Okay, it was probably written by somebody not too far away from Vince McMahon as he was dictating this in his office. All of a sudden, TV ratings are up. All of a sudden, live attendance is starting to improve. We see that fourth quarter number from last year, profitability. All of a sudden, the company is going to get an equity value of $9.3 billion and trade at $100 a share, which was pie in the sky back in 2018 when it got to $100 a share. And Vince McMahon may look at it and say, hey, this isn't that bad. I may not agree with the creative. I don't have the same power I used to have, but I have a much more valuable business for it. I was able to create a much more successful transaction for it. And therefore, maybe it's not the worst thing in the world. I know that's hard to believe knowing all the things we know about Vince McMahon, but in business, money talks. And I don't think anyone expected a year and a half ago or 2 years ago for the company to be valued at what it was valued or to trade at the stock price it trades at. And all of a sudden, there's a lot more cultural relevancy to a company that is now going to be partnered with or be under the same umbrella as UFC, the power that they might have as a partnership. And so that's business. And that might be a bit of a departure from the traditional thinking within the wrestling community.
I just want to give this a quick reality check because I've been thinking, you know, at least I've heard some people say that, you know, well, WWE's popularity did have a turnaround. Did it have a turnaround before Vince actually left? And the scandal broke in the middle of June, almost a year ago now. And we do see in June that SmackDown and Raw were up from the prior year. And okay, well, it's being compared to the prior year, which was the end of the Thunderdome era. So you would expect a month with touring to do better than a month entirely in the Thunderdome. And it probably had a boost because maybe because of, I mean, certainly when Vince came out on TV on June 17th, I mean, that did a big rating. Riddle and Reigns also did a big rating. So, and if we looked at the months before, it was in months where it is being compared in the prior year to the Thunderdome, we've got some slight negatives here or a very slight positive. So, The ratings do add up with that narrative that TV ratings improved after Vince's.
And if you extrapolate this and just look at the trends of ratings over the last 7 to 10 years, it's straight down. Any bit of bobbing out is a positive, and then any uptick from there is success. And that happens to correspond with last summer.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm trying to show here in this green heading. The non-news cable originals, where they're in almost every month, except for March for some reason. It's mostly down, some positive. This month in May actually was flat, probably because basketball, I don't know. So, yeah.
I like to look at the wrestling landscape with more of a business outlook and apply some business thinking to it, not get caught in the kind of tribalism and debating of each company versus each other and whether you give all the credit to one person.
You'll never
or
get
not.
Clicks that way.
And I'm not looking to get clicks, right? I'm just a consumer of this who enjoys looking at the business side of it and speaking with you about it. And that's why I wanted to bring forth that kind of idea, because I think if you look at these as case studies, independent of each other, yes, they borrow from each other quite a bit. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's natural in a competitive industry.
Okay. Anything else before I go to Succession? Because Succession's do you have anything else? And then I'll do a super chat.
Do we have a super chat?
We do or have not a super yet. Chat.
We do. Go for it, because let me see if I had anything else I wanted to put out there while I was on with you.
Dalmar says, Meltzer made a claim that last weekend was the highest crossover between WWE and AEW pay-per-view. Do you think that holds some weight with the SmackDown number? I'm not sure what Delmar means by that. If you want to clarify that in the chat, Delmar, go for it.
I think that weekend had a very good – I think it was a very good weekend for pro wrestling. I think whether you like both shows or not, I think the fact that wrestling dominated that weekend –
Maybe what Delmar is saying is that maybe some people who usually don't watch WWE tuned in to watch SmackDown, who maybe are more so AEW viewers, maybe. I think what Dave reported is based on traditional pay-per-view sales. So we're talking about the people who are still buying WWE pay-per-views, which is like in the low thousands, right? And
I'd be shocked. Is it low thousands? Do you know that?
I think he reported the number. Someone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Someone, that's shocking to me.
So is it shockingly high or low?
I'm surprised there's more than 8,000 still doing it. It's $4, but I understand.
Who knows? It's just broadband access in rural areas. I don't know what's happening.
If you can buy a pay-per-view, do you not have the ability to get... Okay, I digress.
So apparently, according to Dave, wherever he's getting this data from, maybe a certain cable provider or pay-per-view provider, in any case, apparently those people, there was more overlap between the people who bought the Double or Nothing pay-per-view and the people who bought Night of Champions. I wouldn't put too much weight into this, especially if we're talking about a pretty small minority of the entire consumption of this PLE. I think it's probably not that complicated. You have a champion, despite your creation of a new title out of old cloth. You have a champion that's very over and very well protected. You've got a good story that people are into, Bloodline storyline. Mm-hmm. And you've got intrigue coming out of that pay-per-view about where Solo Sikoa stands, why Jimmy did what he did, and people wanted an answer, and you promoted it as this big 1,000-day celebration. Mm-hmm. And look at the quarter-hour, well, the half-hour trends that we looked at earlier. It built and built and built to that last segment. And that's what people tuned in to see. Roman Reigns and the Bloodline's a draw.
I did want to hit on two things real quick. One is a trend that I've observed over the course of the year, this year, 2023 compared to 2022, and that is the ability for each company to keep the, I'll say the active core audience, those who participate in whether it's online discussions or listen to podcasts or get involved in community message groups. They've been able to facilitate conversations in a productive way this year, whereas last year the conversations were very destructive. And you can go back to starting with last year, the Sasha and Naomi story and all the speculation, and you know, everyone gets consumed with what's going on in a negative way, followed by Vince McMahon scandal breaking, followed by the Palace intrigue of that. Certainly with Brawl out, you had Palace intrigue and a lot of negative speculation, and a lot of that's fostered for clicks. And if you follow anything I've ever tweeted, which is not entirely meant to be read serious, I don't really enjoy that. It's a lot of just throwing things out there for their own, you know, for personal benefit of clicks, but it's destructive conversation. And what I've observed this year is that there's a bit more positive conversation. And I'll use two examples in the case of WWE where you can disagree with it creatively or not, right? So I'm not talking about the critical acclaim, but the way the conversation has taken place about the draft and about the new world championship. And in both cases, it gave those outlets something to talk about, and the audience something to discuss. The discourse was about what the draft will mean and who's getting drafted where and what it could mean for the potential of the new world championship. And while it's all muddied and clouded at the end of the day, and there is no real brand split, there is no real brand split per se in WWE, or it's loose at best. It allowed for conversation and speculation about what would happen on screen and not what would happen off of screen. And I think that's a very good development for pro wrestling this year. Similarly with CM Punk, it went from CM Punk should never be back, we all hate CM Punk, to when is he going to be announced for Collision? And the slow build to when he's going to be announced for Collision allowed for many in the community and in the wrestling podcast world to talk about it to their fans. And they led every show with it. And whether that's good or not, I leave that for others to judge. But the conversation was moving towards something, which was his return, which, by the way, was inevitable. The guy was injured. He's going to come back. So now we were able to have a positive conversation about his return opposed to a negative conversation about his leaving. So I thought that was one really interesting trend. The other is this notion of PLEs and the idea that they at some point may be all the rights fees, or the site fees rather, for the PLEs, mm-hmm. and what that means for the wrestling business, specifically WWE as a public company, in their partnership with TK with or partnership, their soon to be merger with Endeavor and TKO. And it gives me this idea of scaled revenue growth. And for a long time, I had kind of been critical of what I late stage capitalism attempts to throw your brand on anything. Let's get the credit cards going. Let's get the lotto tickets going. Let's get our brand on this, our brand on that. It's like, are you materially, incrementally moving revenue that way? No. When you do that, though, when you are able to incrementally scale your revenue, like the case of the PLEs, right? Look what they're getting paid now to run a PLE. Look what they're getting paid
dollars from Puerto Rico
and for Clash of the Castle.
Something from Clash of the Castle. We don't know. $50 million from Kingdom.
That's the outlier, right? That's the big one. But if you are able to all of a sudden drive millions of dollars from these events,
San Antonio gave them something. We don't know.
You're scaling your revenue growth. You have to work. You don't have to work as hard.
LA probably gave them something for WrestleMania.
You don't have to work as hard to achieve incremental revenue growth. Likewise, in AEW, when you're able to run a stadium show, look at what that does on a revenue side, and it's one show. And how many shows, right? So the idea, video game will be the same thing, and that's a big investment they've had to make. So that's, again, different stage company. They're making the big investment to hope to scale that revenue growth, bring in audiences, but it's that concept of getting to a point where you're able to drive more dollars with more efficient means. And I find that to be a fascinating trend emerging for both companies where they are in their respective places over the last certainly this year, as we've seen in the last few months, as the rhetoric has kind of been about these PLEs and about the stadium show in Wembley.
And I would say the stadium shows, both for WWE and AEW, and the video game for AEW have something in common. And I think they're both a really good marketing value. I mean, the video game, I think, is a fan creator. You know, I've said this before, like when I was training people, I would often hear stories about how'd you get into wrestling? Well, I started playing the video games or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that has a strong marketing value and fan creation value. And I think the stadium shows, in addition to, as Nikon has said, in addition to these localized shows being opportunities to bring in the executives and show them the product, so they're not just like looking at WWE on paper, but seeing it in person. That's an important opportunity. And I think it's a strong marketing opportunity to have the video of and the media and the images of, like, look at this huge crowd that we have. And that'll be AEW's first chance to have that when they do the show in the UK with whatever it is, more than 65,000 people there.
Absolutely. And each time they're able to get a better TV deal in a local market, or each time they're able to prove to a local government that they deserve the site fee, right? I think we've always thought about the wrestling business as this selling tickets, selling pay-per-views, selling merchandise in the venues. And those are things that you really have to go hand-to-hand with the consumer on. And these are areas where you can scale that revenue growth in ways that are much more B2B or working with governments. And it's the evolution of wrestling industry.
It's not prepared the analyst, the wrestling fan, to think about wrestling that way. They read wrestling books, and they watch wrestling documentaries even a recent era where it's about ticket sales and TV ratings and pay-per-view buys, and it's become more complicated.
Is a multi-billion dollar industry. This is the evolution of business. This is the evolution of the pro wrestling business. And I think that in the next few years, it'll be interesting to hear all the people who cover wrestling talking like this, I think, because it's obviously where it's headed. And Nick Khan is a great steward for that. And Tony Khan has a great world view of what it's like in sports to understand what needs to happen in order to get his company that he started to where he wants it to go.
I don't know the kid, but seems like a nice kid. It's Nick Khan once said. So, okay. That's it.
Let's do Succession.
Okay. Well, I've got to give everybody a big disclaimer here, an opportunity that if you have not seen the last episode of Succession, and
can I do it?
What?
Go ahead, do it. And then I want to hit the punchline.
If you have not seen the last episode of Succession and you plan to, turn off the podcast now. We're done talking
fuck
about.
Fuck off.
Yes, as Logan Roy would say. We are going to talk about the last episode of Succession here. So there are going to be spoilers. You are going to have the episode spoiled for you if you've not seen it already. So turn off the podcast now. Okay.
Sorry for cursing, Brandon.
It's fine. Logan Roy swears a lot. But he's dead now. Okay.
Rest in peace, Logan.
Who won Succession? Tom Wamsgams won Succession. Are there some ways in which Tom Wamsgams and Paul Levesque are somewhat similar? Would you agree with that analogy?
I think it's pretty good. Keep going.
I've just got some of the Succession characters here. I think there's a number of ways that the politics of the show, the fictional show, seems like what's happened in WWE coincidentally in the last 12 months. Would you agree?
Yeah. I think so too. I think there's a lot of parallels to this, to the arc, right? The creative arc of both shows, if you will. But yeah, the palace intrigue in WWE, certainly the children, the idea of the patriarch. There was always that obvious comparison, but as we saw things play out behind the scenes in WWE and then unfold in a transaction, and we saw how Succession played out in the fourth season, a lot of parallels there.
I mean, my impression is that Logan did not want to give it to any of the kids. All of these people are sort of ruthless nihilists who wanted to keep the power for themselves, and their determination to not let anybody but themselves have the power is what led to no one except for Tom Wamsgams and Mattson getting it. And I think that's probably – I think there's some similarities to my view in you know, Vince – basically having no successor, and Stephanie is out now, and Shane's been out of that picture for years, and Shane is kind of the Conor Roy doing his own thing on the side, and I think Stephanie.
Oh, that's who you think Conor Roy is.
And I think Stephanie is an amalgamation of the other three siblings.
See, I thought Conor Roy, I thought the natural comparison to me was Linda because they spent about $100 million to not even come close to public office, but I digress.
Maybe Conor Roy is an amalgamation of Shane and Linda with political aspirations.
Sure.
And kind of being out of the picture.
I felt bad for Shane. Doesn't have any shares. Came back for one last pop before his dad sold the company.
He had shares. He had the same number of shares given to him as Stephanie did.
No, but at the point of the sale, he tried at the price.
True. He appears to have liquidated them in around 2014 or so. When
you know what the price was around 2014?
Not probably a tenth of what it is now or something.
I think around $18.
Yeah.
Yikes.
And they complete this merger. Well, it was a merger, right, that they did in succession? They completed this merger.
Yeah, they did do a merger. Yep.
And I guess Matt, that would make Mattson like Ari Emanuel or something, right?
You can see Logan saying, "When I go or when I'm done, I want to be swallowed whole. I want them to spit me back up." Right. And that was, you know, that's not the idea of handing, you know, giving the baton to the next. That's not passing it down generation to generation. That's somebody's going to take me on and they're going to swallow me whole. And we've heard Vince kind of, I think that's a Vince quote. And Logan thought his children were not serious people.
Whoever takes me out, I want to give indigestion right, to or something like
right,
that.
Yeah. Some more graphic terms about spit me back up or something. That quote's great. If we can find that. But certainly the three on the slide here, Frank, Carl, and Jerry, I think are natural Frank, Michelle, and George. But who's Nick Khan?
I would say Nick Khan is mostly like Frank and Jerry, I guess.
Yeah, he's in that camp. There's a bit of Nick Khan is the one who grew up outside of the power, outside of the fame and fortune. I find that to be a little bit like Tom Wansgan. It wouldn't shock me if Nick is one of the big winners in all of the WWE session. But Hunter, the obvious comparison there is Hunter and Tom, which I think is great. And you know,
and to be clear, let's just set it up. So Tom wins. He becomes the CEO of the merged company because he has made it clear to Mattson, who's the new boss post merger, that he's willing to be a yes man and do whatever he wants. You know, as long as you know, he needs to be a pain sponge. And he's basically a puppet CEO who's not going to challenge him. He's not going to be a threat to him, and he's not going to stand in the way of Mattson, you know, expressing his vision or whatever.
Yeah, he's an appropriate person on the org chart to sit atop the company. And, you know, similarly, Triple H will take criticisms for creative. That's usually what's lobbied at WWE on a regular basis in terms of its fans. So he will obviously be the pain sponge there. There's also a bit of when they were within the family enterprise, right? Tom was willing to go to jail for Logan. And while I don't think Triple H was ever willing to do anything quite like that for Vince, though we don't know, sure, he kept some secrets. And Triple H has been there since the 90s, early 90s. Like, he's been there a long time, through and through.
There's a similarity that he married into the family. Tom married into
exactly.
the family.
And willing to kind of be the one who will be exiled if need be in the event that Vince decides to sideline him, and what's best for, you know, the next generation, the children, the legacy, is probably
been
best
on the outs,
for all.
But he stayed the whole time.
And that more recently, yes, him being the one that remains in charge in WWE while Stephanie is out is similar to what is going to happen and what Shiv ultimately decided.
Cousin Greg
is some combination of Kevin Dunn and Bruce Pritchard, like these useful idiots who are just institutionalized in the business who are never going to get removed.
Brian James or something.
Brian James. Yeah, that's a good one.
It's somebody who's got to be like a disciple of Triple H.
HBK?
I guess.
Yeah. The Disgusting Brothers.
Yeah.
DX. Degenerates. No, there's a lot of good parallels there, but I think ultimately, if I may, Succession being a commentary on what a British writer thought of American corporate elite, that world, that ecosystem, is that oftentimes the Nepo babies are not serious people. They're not the ones to take over. They're not the ones to be in charge. They've never learned how to actually fight for anything.
Yeah.
And what you can say –
One of the most memorable quotes and maybe the most instructive one is where he says to the kid, Logan says to the kids, mm-hmm. I love you, but you're not serious people. you're my kids and I love you, and they've got, I mean, they're fit to have good jobs and stuff like that, mm-hmm. but they're not fit to be the CEO of a major media company.
Right. And being the leader, being the head of an organization like that, like a, the equivalent of a Fox News, which ATN was presented to be, or the equivalent of a Waste or Roco, which is, think of like a Disney with all the parks, right? Like, that is a job that very, very few people in the world are ever cut out for. And it's usually not because they started on third base. Sometimes it is, but oftentimes it's because they had to make it, like, they, you know, like we heard the origin story of Logan and how he came to be who he was. There's something that has to be burning inside the belly that usually doesn't exist when you're born with the silver spoon in hand. And I think it's interesting as we parallel it to WWE that, you know, Nick Khan, I don't think comes from that background.
Correct.
Triple H did not come from that background. And I think the people who ultimately steward WWE into a successful future are not going to be those who grew up behind the scenes. And that to me is a big takeaway in the WWE session parallel universe that has been created by many fans who like, you know, the show Succession, and we've talked about it and compared it over and over for the last like 2 years now.
The Vince quote, this is from Playboy magazine, February 2001. When it's time for me to go, I would like to be devoured by the biggest, baddest carnivore that ever walked the face of the earth. And then I'd like to give that son of... I fucked it up again. And then I'd like that son of a bitch to get indigestion and vomit my remains back up.
Right. That's a hell of a quote. That's an all-time Vince quote. I like that enshrined.
Okay. Okay, that's it. That's all we've
good
got.
Good chat.
There'll be stuff on the Patreon, patreon.com/WrestleNomics this coming week. We'll have more quarter hour reports. We'll have, updates most likely Monday, maybe Tuesday and Thursday, as we've been doing that in the last couple of weeks. So look for all of that. And thanks.
And I would encourage people to read those news updates that you've been doing. I want to give you compliments on them. They're very informative. They're very succinct, and they are insights to the business that are not rooted in tribalism and whataboutisms and comparisons that are just for fan fodder. So people who do really enjoy WrestleNomics and really do enjoy understanding the business behind the business. Brandon's now doing these news reports and writings that are really good pieces of content. I think each, you know, the frequency that you're putting them out is great.
Yeah, so if you've subscribed before, it's the TV ratings report, but then on top of it, I'm writing some stuff about news, maybe some news notes, but then going into some bigger analysis and sometimes even breaking stories and things like records requests and things like that. So look for that. And I'll talk to everybody next time. Thanks to MJ from NJ for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It was fun. Bye.